Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong, profitable impact on your business.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and my mission every week is to bring you the most interesting entrepreneurs, business people, authors, speakers. I don't care what they do, as long as they are really interested and passionate about what it is that they do, and they're here to freely share their business wisdom, their tips, and their actionable advice with us each week. And today I'm welcoming back to the show my friend Stacey Aronson, who is the fulfiller of Publishing Dreams. And she is here for part six of an extended conversation we've been having about independent book publishing. And by the way, please do listen to segments 1 through 5 so you can have access to all of the information that that Stacey is sharing with us. I've never done this type of a conversation on this show before, but what she had to share from the very first day was so incredibly informative that I had to just have her come back and back and back and back. And today is part six. We don't know if this is the end. It may be, it may not, but please do listen to 1 through 5. So to round out this important series today, you don't want to miss any of this if you're considering writing and self-publishing a book. And she's going to share with us again more tips and advice about the interior layout of your book this time. Stacey, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be back. I've missed you the last couple months.
We have not chatted. We've both been so busy. We're both in growth mode, and we're building products and kingdoms, and we're just doing all kinds of things, and we haven't had a chance to really kind of just visit, and I miss you too. So I'm so glad you're here today.
Thank you. I'm excited to be back. I know that last time I was on, we were hoping that we would get to this topic, but as typically happens, we start talking about whatever the theme of the day is in depth, and the time just flies. So, yes, I'm very excited to talk about this. And I also, before we end today, I also wanted to give some really important tips about contracts, because it's something we haven't talked about, and I do want to let the writers out there know what they should be looking for in a contract when they hire, either a freelance person or even if they work with a company. There are a few important things they need to be looking for. And so I'm not a lawyer or anything like that. I'm not an expert in this, but I do know a few things that are important to be aware of. So I do want to let your listeners know about those things as well. But yes, I'm excited to talk about interiors, because it's all about, book presentation and talking about DIY versus indie publishing and all that good stuff. So, yes, we'll jump in whenever you're ready. You can guide the conversation as you do so well.
Well, let's go ahead and just do a really quick recap on what the first episodes were about. In the first interview, we talked about the self-publishing model, how it can help or hurt your book sales. In the second one, we discussed why DIY, do-it-yourself, and self-publishing are not, capital N, capital O, capital T, one and the same. In part three, we delved into the different types of editing and the importance of each, and that was a fascinating. I mean, all of these are fascinating, but that one really was an eye-opener for me. But here we talked about how editors differ, what you're looking for, and what questions you should ask yourself before interviewing professionals to determine what your particular needs and concerns and wishes and goals are. And we also talked about the different types of editors and how many you may need. 1, 2, 3, 4, you don't know until you really kind of lay your book out. And in part four, we explored interviewing editors, the red flags that you should be paying attention to, and why it's so very important to find the right editor for you as a writer. Then we get to part five, where we discuss the importance of finding the right designers to work on your book cover. And let's face it, If you go on Amazon, I spend a lot of time on Amazon. It's kind of like my Disneyland. I go there all the time. I'm always looking for free books. And I mean, I have an impressive library of Kindle books and real books. And I mean, I'm a reader. But I have to tell you, one of the things that will shut me down quicker than anything is not necessarily the title, but if that book cover just makes my eyes flinch, I'm gone. I don't care what the book is about. If it's ugly, I don't want it in my hands. So, and that's just me. That was just an aside, but I don't think I'm alone with that. So anyway, I'm kicking it back to you, Stacey. What are we talking about today?
Well, first of all, I'm so glad you brought up the subject of covers, because it is that first impression. And when someone's on Amazon and they're looking at thumbnails and the cover feels very amateurish, and sometimes it's hard to explain exactly why that is. A lot of it has to do with typography. A lot of it has to do with placement of the choice of photo or graphic, of color. But you can tell. You can tell a difference. And so last time I was on the show and we talked about all the different elements of cover design, I hope that people who are listening who didn't hear that show will definitely go back and listen, because there are elements of cover design that are crucial. And I think the biggest thing that I want to recap is that when you are a writer, you are not expected to also be a professional editor, a professional cover designer, a layout artist, a proofreader. Those are not your specialties, and they're not supposed to be. And I kind of joke that, you know, like just because you know how to drive doesn't qualify you to be a mechanic, or just because you watch Law and Order doesn't qualify you to be an attorney. You know, but somehow people.
Oh, sure.
I know. There are some of us who think it does work that way.
But I
say that tongue in cheek, because for some reason, writers, when they hear self-publish and the word self is there, they think, oh, that means I have to do everything myself, when that couldn't be further from the truth. I mean, every aspect of book production is a trained expertise. You know, being an editor is a trained expertise. There's instinct, there's education, there's experience, there are, you know, all kinds of things involved. And same thing is true for being an interior layout artist or a cover designer or a proofreader. These are all trained skills. So for a writer to put that kind of pressure on himself or herself and think, oh, well, I guess if I self-publish, I'm supposed to be able to do all of these things. Well, that's just ridiculous. It's crazy, and it's driving people crazy. I mean, I don't want you being driven crazy as a writer. You should be enjoying the process. So I just want to remind everybody, in case you haven't heard any of the other shows yet, that when you are a self-publishing author, it does not mean that you do everything yourself. What it means is that you have the responsibility of writing a great book and then hiring the proper professionals to make it beautiful and presentable and readable and flawless, you know, as much as you possibly can. You have to think like a publisher, ultimately. So when you're a self-publishing author, you really are more of a publisher, and that's how you have to think. Random House does not have one person edit the book, design the book, proofread the book. No, they have a team, and each person on that team, or all the different people on those teams, have specific expertise. And so when you write a book and you decide to independently publish it, it's incumbent upon you to seek out the best team, the best partner. Like for me, I'm a one-stop shop, because I actually am trained in all of those different aspects of book production. But most people are trained in one or maybe two. And so it becomes your job to seek out the best professionals for your book, hire them, work with them. This is why we talked in depth about the questions to ask, to get clear on your particular needs and wishes, and then to know what red flags to look for when you're looking for professionals. So again, I don't mean to keep saying, go back and listen, but we did talk about some really important things. So if you're just tuning in for the first time, I just want to reiterate that we talked about all of that, because so many people say, well, that's all great that you're telling me to hire professionals, but how do I even know what I'm looking for? And what am I supposed to ask people? What am I looking for on a website? What's a red flag? So we talked about all of these things in the previous, I think, two episodes. We talked about these things. So anyway, what we want to look at today is the interior presentation of your book. And, you know, a lot of people think that, well, how hard can it be? I mean, there's really kind of this erroneous belief floating around that, well, you know, I know how to type a manuscript in Word, so it can't be that hard to just lay out the book. You know, I just pick margins and I pick a font and I, you know, decide how far apart the line should be, you know, with line spacing or whatever. I mean, it's crazy because, again, layout artistry is an art, and most people have no idea what goes in to creating an interior of a book. So that's what I want to talk about today, because I want people to understand what goes into it and why it's important to hire a professional. And if you feel really compelled to do it yourself, I'm going to tell you the things that you absolutely have to avoid doing that are telltale signs of a DIY book. So if you're really interested in becoming a layout artist, it's not like you go to college for 4 years to become one. There's instinct involved, and there's, you know, reading and understanding book conventions, and there's creativity, and there's a lot of technical prowess involved. So if you think you have all those characteristics and you want to do it, then I'm going to talk about what things to make sure you don't do and you do so that you will have a really stunning and professional book.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because, listen, in my world, you know, I build websites and I'm an online business manager and virtual assistant, and what I do, honestly, looks like magic to a lot of people. So I will get, which is good, I mean, but I get inquiries from clients and they'll say, oh, Denise, you know, we've got this book and I want you to put it on Kindle. And I'm like, no. No, you need an expert for that. I'm an expert in a lot of things. That is not my field of expertise. And I really, really wish more people would say, listen, we have to draw the line somewhere. Yes, we want our clients to be happy, but I think they'd be happier if they dealt with an expert and not me just kind of elbowing my way into it and going, oh, yeah, I can do that, when I know darn good and well what I'm going to produce is not going to be the best thing that they could have had. So I have learned through trial, well, once I took on a project and said, sure, I think I can do that, and I figured out really quickly that it was not my field of expertise. And for me to learn everything that needed to be done, it would cost this poor guy more than he ever wanted to spend on that book. And it wouldn't have been done right. I would have been horribly ashamed of the end result. So we talked about it, and I said, you know what, I'm going to find you somebody. I'm not it. And it really turned out to be the happiest way to go about it. But that leads me to my next question. It's actually two separate questions, but here's my thinking. When people say, okay, I want a book, I want a real book, a hardback or a paperback, when they're kind of laying this out in their head, should they be thinking about what it's also going to take to have a Kindle book or a print-on-demand book? Because aren't those two separate disciplines?
Yes. E-books okay. are definitely a different layout. A different way that you have to format an e-book so that it actually works as flowable text in any e-reader. Now, Kindle has a proprietary file format called Mobi, and then there's another file format for ebooks called EPUB. And those are that file format works for pretty much any other reader, like a Nook or a Sony. Somebody who does ebooks needs to understand that there can be slight variations between how the book looks in different platforms and how the book is going to look in different Kindle devices. So the nice thing is that Kindle has a previewer tool that you can download. If you're a book designer, you can download it, and you can actually view the book you've created in every different Kindle device to see how it functions. And, you know, most people don't know that. And, you know, one of the big things that has happened in the ebook world is, you know, someone will put a book through a, quote, conversion process, and then it just spits out the supposed EPUB file or a Mobi file.
Right.
But they don't really know how it looks as an end result on that actual e-reader. And the truth is, it doesn't always look very good. I mean, you are a prolific ebook reader, so I'm sure that you have encountered any number of ebooks that have odd, you know, hard returns or odd flow or, you know, weird things happening. So, yes, you should definitely consider doing a paperback and an ebook. I mean, if you're really serious about being a published author, having both, it makes the most sense. Now, if you don't have a budget to produce a print book, and it does take a substantial budget, we did talk about this in the previous show, and you want to start out with an ebook and see how that goes, you still need to make sure that you have someone working with you who knows how to lay an ebook out properly and to preview it in all the different platforms to make sure that it actually does function the way it's supposed to on an iPad or Kindle and all that good stuff. So that's a great question. Because, yes,
well,
both
are
Well,
the reason
important.
I'm asking is because I've in this it popped up again this week. I've got a client who put out a great book, but we actually put the book on ClickBank, and it was one of these projects that I'm really proud of it. This was a couple of years ago, but it was a project we were actually able to link books to videos with inside a membership site. It was very complicated, and we got it done, and it was really the first of its kind. And I'm really, really proud of that. Well, now he wants to put it on Kindle. And I keep telling him, oh, no, it's not going to happen. I'm not going to be the person that destroys that book. I'm going to tell you that much right now. But sometimes people want to put a book on Kindle that I think probably is not suited to be on Kindle. And it's best just to say no, and here is why. So what do you think about that?
Well, there are certainly very complex, typically nonfiction books that do get mm-hmm. tricky put into a Kindle format. For
right,
example,
we've talked about that, right, with
yeah,
Jack's
just
book.
Like one,
mm-hmm.
Right. For example, you can't just wrap text around a photo in a typical free-flowing ebook. It doesn't accept that when you do a conversion. So, you know, if you have a lot of photographs and or images that have text wrapped around them, those don't just convert. Those images like float up and go away from the text, and sometimes the text is formatted strangely. So, again, you kind of have to take the book apart and you have to put it back together in a different way. So all the images are there, but they're not in the exact same way that they look in the print book. Now, there is a style of ebook formatting called fixed format, and there is software, there are professionals who know how to do that. I actually don't know how to do that. But there are people who are experts in that for complex books, like a textbook or like a children's picture book, things like that where the text and the photos and the way they relate to one another are crucial. So that is a possibility, certainly. It's a more expensive process as far as I know, but again, who knows? I mean, software comes out all the time, and there may be easier ways to do it. But in general, it definitely takes more time to reconfigure a nonfiction book that has a lot of bells and whistles, bullets, call-out boxes, you know, things like that, to make it look as close to an ebook as possible. I mean, an ebook, as close to the print book as possible in an ebook format.
Right, right. And that's what I came across with this one. I was already inclined to say, no, that's not in my wheelhouse. But once I understood which book we were talking about, it's definitely not in my wheelhouse. So I'm having a conversation with that client today, and I'll have to find him somebody who can do that type of work. So if anybody's listening and you do that kind of work and you do it well, let me know. I need somebody. Okay,
there's
so let's go back. I'm sorry, go
I'm
ahead.
I'm sorry. I'll give you a resource when we get off.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I have something that might work for something like that.
Oh, okay, great. All right, so now we're talking about the layouts, and because I do read so many ebooks and I read them on different devices, and sometimes you can kind of dink around a little bit with your controls on your machine, whatever it is that you're using. But if it's mm-hmm. a badly laid out book, I don't know about you, I'm a picture straightener. I can't stay there. After a while, I catch myself actually physically reacting to all the mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I catch myself wincing or frowning. So that's not good.
That's not how you want
your book to come across. You don't want people to go, ah, you're making my stomach hurt.
No, you certainly don't. And that certainly does happen with ebooks and odd formatting and you know, odd conversion things that you don't know are happening in the conversion if you're not looking at the end result. But when you're talking about print books too, I mean, print books and ebooks, the idea is that the book should feel seamless to read. Now, most books you pick up from any traditional publisher, even a small publisher, you're not paying a whole lot of attention, a lot of attention to the layout. Why? Because it's been done professionally, and usually, and I say usually because there are Random House and HarperCollins books, and you know that I'm not always in love with the interior, but I'm also looking at it more closely than somebody else might. But sometimes the font seems awfully heavy to me, or you know, very small, or a little too close together, or the margins are a little too narrow. And I know why traditional houses do that. They do it to save money, because book production, printing costs are all about the page count. So the fewer pages you have, the less expensive the book is to produce. So sometimes when you pick up a novel that's quite long, you'll notice the margins are very narrow around the outside. The font size is on the small side. The line spacing, you know, between the lines is also called leading in our industry, is very tight. And they do that to save money. Now, when you're a print-on-demand author, yes, page count is still dictating the cost of the book, but really, I mean, we as interior layout artists in our community, it's kind of a small community, but we talk about how when you're working with print on demand, you can go back to the traditional much. Traditional book design and things that make the reading experience very smooth and seamless, I mean, that's really what you want to be producing for a reader. The reader should not be having a visceral reaction in a bad way to how the book looks. Then something is really wrong. And yes, it happens in ebooks a lot of times just because the person doesn't even know what's happening in the conversion process or they don't know how to lay out the ebook properly. And certainly in the print world, when we have authors doing DIY layout in Word, which is not a page layout program, you're going to have all kinds of telltale signs of DIY, and it is not going to be a good experience for the reader. And that's why we're talking about this subject today, because I really want to make sure people understand all the things that go into it to make it, well, you know, a seamless experience.
Exactly. And the thing is, perception is everything. I mean, we've heard that all of our lives. Perception is everything. And if the perception that, you know, you get this great book, it can be a great book. But if somebody is holding it in their hands or on their iPad or their Kindle going, ow, ooh, okay, I can't take this person seriously. They just lost credibility with me.
That's exactly
what
that's
not good. It does.
It
really
does.
It's not
good. It's not good, and this is something we have talked about over and over in our series here together, is that that impression that the reader gets from that book is going to stay with them pretty much forever. So unless somebody loves you, it's your mother or your spouse, or, you know, if you produce a substandard book the first time, you pretty much shot yourself in the foot by doing it, because it's going to be on Amazon forever. It is. Really, it's pretty impossible to get a book off Amazon once you've put it there. So if you produce a substandard book because you wanted to save money, you thought self-publishing meant I do everything myself, which is crazy and ridiculous, you know, whatever your motive was to produce that substandard book, you have really just completely hurt yourself, because now you've put a book out there that's giving readers a horrible impression, whether it's the cover and the interior, the lack of editing, the lack of proofreading, you know, whatever it is. It's very rare that someone's going to give you a second chance when you say, oh, okay, now I realize I made all these mistakes. Let me do the book over. Let me do it better the next time. You know, how many people who saw the bad first version are going to come back for the second version thinking it's going to be better? It just doesn't usually happen. I think partly we're programmed as humans to be aware. If something has a really bad taste in your mouth the first time, it's probably not a good idea to go back again. Now, you know, we should try foods throughout our lives and acquire taste and things like that. But, you know, in general, if you see something or read a book that's not so hot, what are the chances, Denise, that you're going to say, oh, the author produced a second version of this book with a brand new cover It's supposedly different. I mean, are you going to revisit that book when you really couldn't stand it the first time? I mean, it's,
no.
It's kind of rare that someone's going to take the time to do that.
Right.
So one of the things that we touched on before and that I want to emphasize is it does absolutely no one any good to produce a substandard book. It is terrible for readers. It is terrible for the literary community, and it is a terrible reflection on you as an author. So don't do it. I mean, that is the easiest statement I can make, is don't do it. If you don't have the money to produce a high-quality print book, wait, save, do it right the first time. Because I'll tell you, I've had more than one client come to me who did a DIY first version, then found me and said, I really want to do this right. I didn't know what I was doing the first time. I thought I could do it on the cheap. I thought I could lay it out in Word. I mean, I've heard all kinds of excuses. And now I realize how bad it is. I'm getting all these bad reviews. People are telling me it's terrible. I feel terrible as an author. And so now I want to do it right. Well, that's wonderful. And I'm very happy to take a book that was poorly done and turn it around and make it into a book that's done with excellence. But the problem is that substandard book is stuck on Amazon forever. And so there are these two versions of the book, and hopefully the person's going to gravitate to the better cover and, you know, the better book description or whatever it might be that the reader is drawn to. But nonetheless, it's really hard on an author to try and recoup, bad reviews or a bad reputation or whatever it might be that's left a sour taste in a reader's mouth. So you don't want to do it wrong the first time. You want to be a published author who is respected and people are excited about reading your book. And, of course, your book's not going to appeal to everybody. It doesn't matter if it's a memoir or a novel or nonfiction. But it should at least be professionally done. I mean, you want that for yourself as an author. So that's why we're talking about all these things.
I agree. Listen, I saw something I thought of you the other day. I saw this in a group that I'm in on Facebook. And basically they were saying that, you know, just get it out there. You know, get the book out there. Get your manuscript to the editor. And somebody made the comment that an imperfect title book done and published is better than a perfect title constantly being revised and reworked. And I get that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do, and I get that, because a working title is just that. But doesn't there come a point where you have to say, this is the title, and I can't keep changing it in Amazon as I have a better idea, because I've seen that done.
Yes. I mean, personally, I think it's important to spend as much time as you need to fine-tune everything, your
mm-hmm.
title, subtitle, your cover, your content, you know, everything. And, of course, you can rewrite a book to death. I've rewritten my novel 14 times. I'm not done rewriting it. And that is not unusual. I've you know, read about other writers or talked to other writers who've done many more rewrites than that. But there is a point. You know, when you're working with a professional editor, too, of course, that makes all the difference. You have to realize that there's a point when it's time to stop rewriting, when it's time to stop questioning every character or every chapter or whatever it is you're questioning. And it's hard because we're very vulnerable as writers. We want people to like what we put out there. And the truth is, not everyone's going to like it. It's just not going to appeal to everybody. And that's okay, because there's no one book that appeals to absolutely everybody. So what we need to do is, like you said, there has to come a point where you call it a done deal. You shouldn't do that until you've had professionals work with you, certainly. But there definitely is a point where you need to say it's ready and you need to put it out there. And you need to not start thinking about all the things you should change because you get a little comment here or there. I mean, it's very tempting with print on demand. You can actually go back and make changes and then re-upload your files, and there's a little bit different book out there. And nobody really knows the difference unless they have both and they're comparing. But it is, it's a detriment to writers, the whole rewriting thing. I mean, writing is all about rewriting, but there's definitely a time when you have to call it a done deal.
Right, and then you get to how you're going to, you know, lay it out. So let's talk about tips and tricks for the interior presentations. What do people need to know? Let's just assume that they're not going to hire someone, that they're going to actually have someone to do it. What do they ask people? You know, what kinds of questions do you ask the person that you're thinking of working on your book? What do you ask them so that you know they're the best person for you?
Well, one of the things I've seen a lot of is sort of the charlatan interior layout artist. You know, people who just work in Word and think, how hard can it be? It's the same mentality that writers have about laying out their own books. So it is important, just like in any field, there are people who claim they can do something well who really can't. But if you are looking online, for example, a couple of really great resources are writersmarket.com. There's a section on that website where it says paid services, and there's a plethora of resources of layout artists, cover designers, editors. It's a really good place to start because you can see a little blurb about these people. Their inclusion in Writer's Market is a good thing. It doesn't necessarily mean they're proven to be excellent, but it is a good start. And then once you can see a website for the person, if you read a bio and you feel a connection or whatever it is, you can go to the website. There should always be a portfolio there. You should always be able to see examples of layouts, preferably two-page layouts, so you can actually see like a screenshot of a two-page layout of a book. And you should be able to see different kinds of books. Now, some people might just do novels and memoirs. Some people might do complex nonfiction. I actually do both, but I know of a couple of colleagues who just don't want to touch complex nonfiction. They just rather stay away from it because it's a lot of work. Now, I happen to love it, but some interior designers, book interior designers, don't. So you want to look for the right fit for your particular book. I had a client last year, just for a really quick example. When we first talked, he said, now, my book is going to be complex. I want bullets. I want call-out boxes. I want images. I want graphics and tables and charts. You know, this is the kind of book I'm doing. Is this something that you are good at, that you're experienced in, that you want to do? And this was a great question for him to ask me because, sure enough, I was experienced in it and I loved doing it and I was all excited about it. And so that made him excited about it. But, of course, my reaction was important. So when you are interviewing somebody and you're looking at your own book, and maybe you have a complex nonfiction book, and you're asking that question, you know, how is the reaction of the person? It's very important to talk to people on the phone because a voice is very different
yes.
from an email and very different from just reading right. what someone does on a website. It's very static. So when you hear someone's voice and you hear someone say, well, yeah, I could do that, it's very different from, oh, my gosh, I love doing complex nonfiction. I will be so excited to do a book like yours. I mean, you can hear the difference. So how somebody reacts, and hopefully is genuine, makes a big difference. So that's something you definitely want to think about, is matching yourself with the right type of layout artist who does the type of book you're doing. Now, having said that, you definitely, as I said, want to see examples. And anybody who is a professional layout artist, even if you find them on a site like Elance.com or Odesk.com where you can find freelancers, because most layout artists work as freelancers, so you're not necessarily going to go to some big company and then hire out their layout artist. Most of us work as freelancers. So if you go to a site like that, there's, you know, obviously a place where you can have a portfolio on that site. But if for some reason the person doesn't, but maybe they have a website, you know, you want to be able to see examples. And those examples should immediately look to you like a traditionally published book. If you see it and you think, that doesn't really look like the kind of books I buy. Something looks weird or it looks unprofessional or something. You know, red flag. Move on to the next person. So it's really about doing that due diligence. You need to find people. You need to go online, search out different resources. And then once you do that and you feel like, okay, this is a good candidate, this sounds like a good candidate, make a list, write down all the websites, and then go to all the websites. See what the deal is. What kind of portfolio are you looking at? Is it a robust one? Is it one example? Do you have to email them for more examples? I mean, I think that's weird. I put every single book I do on my website. As soon as I'm done, that interior layout goes up there, the cover goes up there, you know, whatever it is I'm working on. So I want people to see a variety of things, and hopefully they'll see something that, you know, clicks. It's like, oh, okay, she does the kind of book that I'm doing. That's a good start. So that's something that
And, of course, your current work. I mean, you really should keep your portfolio current no matter what
Absolutely.
You do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I went on a site one day. I was looking for layout artists for a client who needed something super fast, and I was way too busy for it. And he said, well, let me see if I can find someone for you. And I went on, I found a site, and the person had one book, but yet seemed to be like this, you know, had been doing this work for years, and yet there was one example. And I thought, you don't give one example to a prospective client. It just doesn't say anything about your work. It either says you're hiding something, you're not being genuine about how long you've been doing it, or, you know, you really don't have any other examples, and you're kind of claiming that you do, and so you can email me for more. I don't know. It just seems strange to me. So, you know, think about things like that. If something feels off to you, trust your instinct, because this is a person who's going to take your baby and lay it out, is going to present all of this content that you work so hard on to your reader. And there really is a lot to it. I probably go through every book I do, even if it's just a memoir or a novel, 15 to 20 times just doing layout. It's a lot. It's a lot of passes, a lot of steps, a lot of things to look for. It's very technical, along with being very creative. So you definitely want to find somebody who is proficient in it, and the way to see that really well is to see examples. So having a little bio and some background and, you know, whatever, that's all great. But really seeing the work is going to be probably the most important thing you can do. And once you see the work and you say, okay, let's check this person on my list. This one looks good. Let's check this one. This one has good portfolio. Then you want to talk to the person. So it's really important, again, to have that phone conversation. Now, maybe the person only does paid phone consults. That is the case for some people. Some people will do a free consult for 15 minutes or half an hour, whatever it is. I mean, some of those aspects might be a deal breaker for you. If someone's phone consult is $200 and that's way out of your budget, then maybe you want to look at someone who has a free consult or a more minimal consult fee. That's not really a deal breaker. Just because someone has a super expensive phone consult rate doesn't mean they're so much better than someone who has a lesser consult rate. I, for example, you know, one of my colleagues says, I don't know why you don't charge so much more for phone consults. And I said, because I want people to have access to me. I want them to be able to make a decision and not break the bank by just having a brief interview with me. So I keep my phone consults really reasonable for that reason. But that's just me. It doesn't mean I'm better than the guy who charges $200. It just means that's a decision I've made right now in my particular business. So, again, you want to trust your instinct. You want to do your homework. Googling interior layout artist or book layout artist or book interior design, those are good keywords. And you'll find a lot of articles on the subject, but you'll also find people who do the work. And as I said, Writer's Market is a really great place to go, writersmarket.com. There's also, you know, as I said, Odesk and Elance that have freelancers. But just be aware that a lot of those freelance sites, too, they have people from all over the world. And you may want to look for U.S.-based book designers because book conventions here can be different from book conventions overseas. You're not really sure if the person knows exactly how we do things here. Again, if they have a portfolio and everything looks great, then you're probably fine. But you just want to take those things into consideration. How easy will it be to communicate with this person? How do they charge? Do they charge by the project? Do they charge based on how long the book is? Do they charge by the hour? So just be very aware of what you're paying for and what you're getting. If you're paying a flat fee, what are you getting for that flat fee? Does that include so many changes? Does that include so many concepts for you to pick from? You know, how does it work? So those are things that you want to be asking when you're looking for providers.
And these are not things that you would think to ask for, I mean, unless you're listening to us, because, I mean, who would think about this? I mean,
oh,
honestly,
exactly.
I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
Most people wouldn't. Exactly. And that's why it was so important to me to talk about this subject. Now, those are obviously initial questions to ask to kind of get your main people, the main candidates for you, down to a good group. But when you're ready to talk to somebody, you want to talk about some different topics that are very important in book design, like how do you choose the typography for my book? Typography is the first thing we do as a layout artist, is to figure out what fonts, and usually there's more than one, what fonts are going to reflect this person's material the best. Times New Roman, let me just tell you right now, is a manuscript font. It is not a book font. We do not ever typeset a book in Times New Roman. So when I see a book in Times New Roman, it's a red flag. It's a DIY book.
It's hard to read. It's very difficult to read. It's hard on your eyes.
It is. And so it's fine for manuscripts. It is not fine for books. There are many, many, many fonts that are traditional that look similar, but there are nuances in fonts. There are different reasons why I choose specific fonts for books. And for me, this is a question you asked me, I think, a couple of episodes ago. It was such a great question. You said, do you work more from instinct or from experience or, you know, training? And I said, you know, a lot of it for me is instinct. Now, for me, I have what I call a gift. I don't take credit for it. I have a gift for having a sense of how a book should look. I kind of visualize it, and I have a sense of typography and different things that are going on with an interior that reflect that person's content or that author in a particular way. So if you have a layout artist who says, well, I just use Times New Roman for every book, or I just use, you know, Helvetica for every book, or some standard web font. I mean, none of those fonts are ever used for a book. So, you know, you want to make sure that that person has some expertise in typography, because it's a huge thing. I mean, imagine if you see a sign in the wrong kind of font. If you see somebody's professional sign or an article written or something in, like, Comic Sans, for example, you're like,
oh, no.
It has a cartoony feel to it. It doesn't feel professional
at all.
It does. You know, you just can kill a book completely with the wrong typography. So that is step number one, and it's a big one because we're creating actually a hierarchy of typography. So when you have subtitles, when you have subtitles, you know, those all have to be different. And not that the font itself is different, but you have to figure out, okay, is the subtitle going to be in all caps or small caps? Or are we going to do title case for, you know, for this type of subtitle? And what are we going to do for chapter headers? And which font is going to complement the main text font? Many times when you're doing nonfiction, you have a complementary sans serif font for things like call-out boxes or quotes or inset things in the book, whereas your main text is typically going to be a serif font because it's typically easier on the eyes to read, especially for novels and longer books. Now, specialty books might, you know, you can kind of go outside the norm sometimes for specialty books, but in general. So these are things that the average Joe, the average writer, is not going to know. And you know what? You're not supposed to know it because this is not your expertise. So, you know, I don't want you to put a whole bunch of pressure on yourself that, oh, my gosh, I wouldn't have known this. How am I supposed to know? Well, you wouldn't normally know. And that's why we're talking. That's why we're having the show, because I wanted to share with you things that you should know.
Right.
So typography is very, very important. Again, how the text is actually laid out when you're talking about line spacing and the size of the font. You know, if your font is just too big, the book looks amateurish. If it's slightly too small, it frustrates the reader. There's a very, very special in-between that feels right. So I'm always printing my books out. Sometimes I'll reduce the font by half a size, just half a size for the main text, and it's perfect. Sometimes I have it at 1.2. Sometimes a certain font is better at 1 or 1.1 or even 1.3. It just depends. But again, those are things that a really good layout artist is going to experiment with so that your book has the proper length, it has the proper feel page to page, and the proper feeling of flow. Another thing that you want to be thinking about is what pages fall on a right-facing page, which is correcto. Which ones can fall on a left-facing page. So, for example, one of the clients who came to me and said, okay, I did my book by myself and I didn't do the best job. Well, I think he broke every single rule of book design that you could possibly imagine. And he's such a sweet man, and bless his heart for saying, I need you to redo it and redo it right. But well, one of the things I noticed immediately, because he sent me a copy of the book, was that his front matter was it was on the wrong pages. So, for example, his table of contents started on the left, when table of contents should always start on the right. A title page is always on the right. The copyright page is always on the left. I mean, there are things that you can learn just by picking up 10 books on your shelf and looking at them, and you will see certain things that are always the same. And those are some of those things. So when you have front matter, which is the part of the book that comes before, say, the preface or the introduction, so title pages, a copyright page, a dedication, an epigram, which is an opening quote, those things, all except for the copyright page, those always fall on a right-facing page. Sometimes a dedication can be on a left page. So, see, there are little nuances where there's not necessarily a rule for every single thing, but certain things there are rules for. And when you have, a table of contents starting on the left and the first chapter starting on the left page, you know, ooh, big red flag. So first chapter, preface, introduction always starts on a right-facing page. The other thing is your front matter, again, title page, copyright page, dedication, those kinds of things, are not numbered. They do not have page numbers. They do not have running page headers. And a lot of people, when they set up their book in Word and think they are a book designer, they don't realize that there are special settings when you're working in an actual book design program that will eliminate those page numbers and those page headers from front matter, where you can change them according to every section of the book. If you set up a book in Word, typically you'll see that the very first page says page one and it's a title page. Oh, that's just a killer for me when I see things like that. A blank page, for example, should never be paginated. If you have a blank page, it does not have a page number and it does not have a page header. So no header, no footer. Those are things that happen when people try to do their books themselves because they don't have the right program. They don't know how to use a program that is appropriate, and they don't know how to actually manipulate the program and create the settings that eliminate things like that, that are total red flags of a DIY book. The same is true for back matter when you're talking about acknowledgments and about the author. You know, those pages are typically not paginated either. They don't have running page headers. So these are things that I'm throwing out there that I want people to be aware of. Another really big thing, now this is not true in ebooks because ebooks have flowing text. So we're not manually breaking words in ebooks because we don't know how the flow is going to work depending on how the person sets their e-reader font and the size of that font. But in print, this is very, very important. When you set up a book, you're always going to want the book to be in justify mode, so the right edge of your text is even. Not a ragged edge, but a justified edge. And ragged edge is a very telltale sign of DIY, so you want to keep that in mind. When you set your text up in justify, not every line is going to space out perfectly. Sometimes there's going to be a lot of space between the words because a word falls on the next line that's really long, like understanding or transformation or something like that. Those are things that layout artists are looking for, line by line by line. And when we see that, we create manual word breaks so that, say, the word transformation, trans pops up to the line before and formation, you know, lands on the line below, and that fixes that awkward wide spacing. Now, most people aren't going to know that. They don't know that because they're not layout artists and they're not supposed to know that. So again, as a writer, these are things that you wouldn't normally know, but I'm giving you some tips. If by chance you're really, really passionate about doing your own book and you really want to learn how to do it right, it's important to know all the book conventions. There are definitely rules that you need to follow, and if you don't follow them, you're going to have that DIY telltale sign. I don't want that for you. So making sure that, you know, each line, how the words are spaced is important. Those are things you need to have a very close technical eye for. Same is true for margins. Again, if your margins are way too big, it looks very amateurish. It looks like, why are the margins so big? Is there not enough content to fill up a page? So you want to create margins that feel very natural, you know, like an inch at the bottom, an inch at the top is pretty, 7.5 on the right-hand edge, usually an inch on the interior is about perfect. You don't want it to be so difficult for the person to read the book that when they're holding the book, their thumb is always covering words, or that the binding is so close to the interior that you can't see. You have to open the book really, really far. So again, these are things that sometimes you won't know until you actually see the book in your hands. But that's a really important thing to be thinking about. So another little special thing is those customized first letters. So you know, Denise, when you're reading a book and you open a chapter and the first letter is
I love those. Stylized.
Yes,
yeah, we use those
too.
In web development too. Sometimes they're appropriate and sometimes they're really not.
Yeah,
same thing in web development.
It really depends, exactly. And so, for example, if I'm laying out a novel, and the novel is it's women's fiction, it has a very flowery feel, it's a very, you know, women's feel, then I may use a very stylized cursive, something that, of course, matches the cover font or the chapter header font that I've chosen. It's always got to be complementary. That's the important thing, because it feels right for the book. If I'm working on a nonfiction book that's very professional, I'm going to use a very, you know, much more standard block style font or, you know, a serif font, something that, again, that coordinates with another font I've used in the book as a first letter. So those are not just taking the first letter and making it huge. That's not how that works. We actually make those letters in a graphic program, and we insert them in one at a time. We create the proper spacing around it, the proper size, the way it falls on the line, the way it lines up with the words and all that. So those are things that, again, a regular Joe would never know how to do. But those are special things that make a book feel very professional, very traditional. And most readers are never even thinking about it. They're just enjoying it. And sometimes it's because it's expected. So that's another little thing to know about.
And the best thing about books, and this has been my lifelong experience and yours as well, because we've chatted about this, we all have books that we pick up and we read them over and over and over again throughout our lifetime. There is no one book in my house or my garage. I have about 3,000 books, probably more, physical books. Every single one of them I have read at least twice, and some of them way more than that. I mean, I have one book. It's an old Reader's Digest that I swiped off my mom's bookshelf when I left home at 17. I, you know, moved out, got out of high school, left, and took my favorite books with me. Kind of forgot to ask her if I could do it, but they got packed. And there's one that I still have. Every once in a while, she'll call me and say, "Do you happen to have?" No. And I'm looking right at it. But sorry, Mom. But there's a book called Merry Christmas, Mr. Baxter. And I think it was written in the 50s, maybe even the late 40s. It was an old Reader's Digest that my parents had. You know, they were like me. They just books everywhere. And I read that book without fail every year, and I have done so since I was about 10 years old.
Oh, I love that.
It's just one of the, and I open it and I smell it and it's perfect and it's just as part of my Christmas tradition. And there are books, and you're not going, my point for saying this is not to admit to stealing books from my mom's house. I didn't steal them. I relocated them, if anybody's asking. But I know where they're at.
Yeah.
They're right here. They're 2,500 miles away from her, but they're safe. But the thing is, you're not going to do that with a book that bothers you viscerally, or, you know, if it's not right, if it doesn't open up and feel right and read right and look right to you, it doesn't matter how great that book is, you're not going to revisit it, are you?
No.
And isn't that
the
point of having books, is so that they live a lifetime?
Absolutely.
And beyond?
Yes. There are certainly novels I've reread over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Certain children's books I love,
right,
that I've kept, that I've rebought even, that I love. But like you read them every season or whatever.
Right.
And certain nonfiction is
The Secret Garden. I read that all the time. I've read that 100 times, probably The Secret Garden.
That's,
I love that book.
That's a wonderful book. I agree.
Yeah.
But yes, and certain nonfiction is meant to be a reference. It's meant to be opened and used and sometimes written in and, you know, used over and over again to go back to and reference. So if you're going back to a book over and over and the presentation just feels very unprofessional, you're not going to feel that great about the content or the author, even if the content is great. because that visual presentation is so important. So I know we're getting really close to time, and I really did want to mention something about contracts, but just like a really quick rundown.
Okay, great.
If you're listening on the replay, you can pause this and jot these down. If you are trying to do your own book, and again, I don't recommend it, but if you really have a passion for it and you are using an appropriate program like InDesign or Apple Pages, not Word, please do not lay out your book in Word. These are telltale signs of DIY, so make sure you avoid them. Do not use Times New Roman or any other typical Arial, Verdana, Helvetica. Do not use those fonts in your book layout. Do make sure that you do not have a ragged right edge. Make sure all of your text is justified. Make sure that you do not indent paragraphs too large, like a 0.5 is too big, 0.25 is perfect. You shouldn't have big spaces between paragraphs unless you're using a block style, which means every paragraph starts justified to the right with no indent. If you're using continuous paragraphs, which is typical of most novels and narrative nonfiction and all of that, you're going to have a paragraph, another paragraph with an indent, another paragraph with an indent with no spaces in between unless you have a time break, and then you have a break. You don't want your margins too terribly large. You don't want any running page headers, front matter on blank pages. You don't want page numbers on blank pages or front matter or about the author or acknowledgments. Those are really important. You want to make sure that certain sections that are supposed to be on a right-facing page are on a right-facing page, not a left-facing page. And you also need to be really technically attentive to how words fall on lines, line by line by line. And I'm telling you, it takes a really careful eye to go through a book, and that's why I go through a book 15 to 20 times, to make sure that you don't have awkward spacing between words and certain lines. You need to create manual word breaks, and you need to create them in the right place at the right syllable. Your chapter headers should be fitting. They should be nice. They should be creative most of the time. They can be simple. That's fine. But they should at least be in a proper font, a proper complementary font. So those are just some red flag things to heed if you really have your heart set on trying to do this by yourself.
Thank you. I mean, that's really good information to have. And not only that, I mean, if you're going to try to do it on your, even if you decide not to do it on your own, you need to be able to ask those questions of whoever is going to be working on it with you so you know what you're getting. And we ran out of time for contracts, didn't we? About how much time do you need for contracts? Should we schedule you for another hour or half hour, or what should we do here?
Here's what I want to do. I just want to let you know as a writer that when you hire any kind of professional, a freelancer, you know, any kind of contractor to work on your book, you should have a contract. Don't work with somebody who doesn't do a contract. A contract protects you as the author, and it protects the provider for things like payment, for things like how the relationship is going to go, what you're paying for if you're paying a flat fee. Everything needs to be laid out in a contract. It doesn't have to sound like a lawyer wrote it with all these crazy terms and things that are over your head. My contracts are very straightforward and simple, but I did have a lawyer go over it and say, this is perfect, this works. And, you know, and she tweaked a few things here and there for me. But basically, you want to make sure that what you're contracting that person for is laid out in a contract that both of you sign, and that you have an exit clause. If you decide you don't want to work for this person anymore or with this person anymore, how do you get out of it? Are you putting all your money up front? I don't recommend that. Do not pay for something that hasn't been done. Now, I request a 25% deposit. I know some professionals require half, a 50% deposit before they start. You know, I work against that deposit until that deposit is fulfilled, and all of that work the author is seeing all along. Before a bill even comes across their email, they are seeing the work they're paying for. So make sure that if you are putting down a deposit, that you know what that means and it's laid out in the contract. What happens if you break your contract before that deposit has been met? There needs to be a clause in there that says you're going to get that money back. You don't want to be giving, you know, $1,000 to somebody and then they flake out, they don't do the work you expected, you don't have a good relationship, whatever it is that happens, and you say, you know what, this isn't working for me, I would like to break our contract, and the person says, well, the deposit's mine. No, I don't want that to happen to you. So make sure that when you hire somebody, first of all, you've done your homework, you've looked at their testimonials, you've looked at the portfolio. If you want to talk to somebody they have worked with before, don't be afraid to ask. I've had people ask me that. Can I actually talk to some of your prior clients? Even though I have a website full of testimonials, they want the voice connection with someone I've worked with, and I don't blame them, and I'm fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think that's a great idea.
It is important. And so if I had something to hide, then I might say, oh, no, my clients, you know, prior clients don't want to do that or something. You know, so just, again, trust your gut. This is your baby. This is something you've probably been working on for years. This is a dream for you to be a published author. You want the people you hire to be trustworthy, to do what they say they're going to do. And these things should be laid out very clearly in a contract. If something is missing from the contract, don't be afraid to ask about it. Say, well, there's not a clause that talks about this, or what happens in the event that this happens? I mean, I've tried to address every what if in my contract, and I honestly think I've only one time had somebody ask me a question like, well, what if this happens, and I didn't have it in the contract, and then I added it. But, you know, you need to feel very comfortable about what you're signing. So if anything feels convoluted, feels deceptive, feels like it doesn't make sense, make sure that you ask about it or ask the person to rewrite it a little bit different way so that it makes sense. I mean, don't be afraid. This is your money you're spending, your hard-earned money to fulfill a dream. And the person you're handing over your work to should be very forthright in a contract about the work that's going to be performed, the cost of that work, how that cost is going to be calculated, whether it's by the hour, by the page, whatever it is. You should have an exit clause. If either one of you wants to get out, how does that work? If the deposit isn't fulfilled and you break a contract, how does that work? You definitely want to make sure that you have both signed it before you start. And you definitely, this is super important, want to make sure the rights of what you're paying for belong to you. Now, this is a huge problem with people who hire these predatory companies, and I hate to throw out names, but the bottom line is they are predatory companies who take your money and they take the rights to your cover art, your interior layout, and all that kind of stuff. So you can never take it anywhere else and publish it yourself, like Author House, Author Solutions, Balboa Press. Their contracts, I've never seen one, but I'm sure that there's no place in there that says the author reserves the right to this artwork we're doing or this layout we're doing. You're paying them to do it, and they own it. Now, when you work with an individual like me or somebody else, my contract clearly states, once you pay me for your cover art, the cover art belongs to you. Once you pay me for your interior layout, that interior layout belongs to you. Now, what that means is, if that author wants to take that book to, you know, Ingram to publish, to CreateSpace to publish, to whatever platform they choose, they can. It belongs to them. You never want to work with a provider who doesn't give you the rights to that artwork. If they say, well, I do the artwork, you pay me, but the artwork belongs to me, you can't ever take it anywhere else and publish it except for where I publish it for you. That is a red flag. So just be really smart when you hire people. Make sure there's a contract, number one. Don't ever work with someone without one. And do make sure that those clauses I talked about are there, and that if there's any problem or any confusion about anything, that you ask about it, and don't be afraid to ask for something to be reworded or something to be added. Again, this is your baby and your money, and I want you to be safe when you work with people. So that was five
Excellent.
Minutes. We got enough in there.
We got it. Listen, tell people where they can find you on the web.
Yes, I would love for you to come and see me at thebookdoctorisin.com. I have all of my services there. I am a professional editor, a developmental editor for nonfiction, copy editor for fiction and nonfiction. I'm a proofreader, a cover designer, a layout artist. I'm a publishing professional, so I can do all of the publishing stuff for you through Ingram, through CreateSpace, through both. Basically, I take your hand and take you through the whole process from a raw manuscript to a beautiful, beautiful book of excellence in your hands that will absolutely rival or exceed a traditional house publication. And I say that because I take a lot of pride in what I do. I love books. I love authors. I'm a writer, and it's very important to me to take really great care of authors and see them fulfill a dream. That's why I call myself the fulfiller of publishing dreams. So you can find me at thebookdoctorisin.com. You can get a free Chock Full of Secrets video if you want at savvyauthormastery.com. That's savvyauthormastery.com. And we are giving away today, once again, my master do's and don'ts list of self-publishing that is chock full of live link resources for you. I know Denise put it up in the description. If you are listening to the replay, it will be there right on the page where they're viewing or listening. Is that right, Denise?
That is correct, and it's on my website. I had you on mute.
Okay,
I'm sorry. I was coughing. I didn't want to cough in the microphone. It's also on my website, denisegriffiths.com.
Oh, perfect. So if you want to pick that up, I did that for Denise's listeners. It's a whole bunch of information about what to do, what not to do, with lots of information and a bunch of resources at the end of where you can find editors, where you can find designers, and so I hope you find it super helpful. And if you are interested in connecting with me, I have a questionnaire on my website called Tell Me About Your Book Project, and if we're a good match for each other, we can do a phone consult, no obligation, but I'm always super excited to have wonderful authors cross my path and forge wonderful partnerships with them. So it's certainly not meant to be a sales pitch, just meant to let you know that I'm out there as a partner, as a resource, and happy to help however I can.
Stacy, thank you. I mean, you have given so much time. I mean, 6 episodes. Nobody else has done this. In fact, I haven't asked anybody. And you have been so gracious about it. And you have just been, I mean, seriously, a huge, huge resource for my listeners, for my community, the web development community, the virtual assistants community. I mean, honestly, you're just a tremendous resource. And I appreciate you more than you can possibly know.
Oh, well, the feeling is mutual, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show again. So thank you so much for having me back. It's been my pleasure.
Well, I'm going to give you a call because as we were talking in the green room, I have a big project underway that I want you to be part of. So I will be calling you back shortly.
Okay.
Because, well, listen, everybody, the show is available for download in about an hour, maybe less. And you can find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Stacy Aronson, and I will see you next week. Stacy, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.